6. Advocating the elimination of gender-based discrimination. The 1970s new look at the equality principle. In the 1970s, a revived feminist movement blossomed in the United States. I was in those years a law teacher, general counsel to the American Civil Liberties Union, and a founder of the ACLU's Women's Rights Project. It was my good fortune to be in the right place at the right time, able to participate in the effort to place women's rights permanently on the human rights agenda in the United States. In these remarks, I will recall those now long ago days and describe from my personal perspective and experience what that 1970s effort entailed. Most of the world's nations have rather new constitutions, written since 1970. Newer fundamental instruments of government generally contain a broad equality clause, specifically prescribing discrimination on the basis of race, sex, ethnic origin, sexual orientation, religion, and other group characteristics. A few among many examples, Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms, adopted in 1982, has such a catalog, as does South Africa's post-apartheid constitution and the European Convention on Human Rights. In contrast to latter 20th century rights declarations, the U.S. Constitution is over 220 years old. It is the oldest written constitution still in force in the world. Except for the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote in 1920, our Constitution contains no express provision regarding discrimination on the basis of gender. Indeed, the Constitution contained no equality prescription at all until after the Civil War. Equal protection jurisprudence in the United States principally involves interpretation of the spare 14th Amendment command that governing authorities shall not deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. Those words, inserted into the Constitution in 1868, were once interpreted narrowly, but over time they proved to have growth potential. In the 1890s, the U.S. Supreme Court said that racial segregation, mandated by state law, was compatible with the Constitution's equal protection principle. By the middle years of the 20th century, however, the Supreme Court came to recognize how wrong that judgment was. State-imposed separation along racial lines, the court acknowledged in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, at least in public education facilities, could never be equal. Yet until 1971, the court turned away every woman's complaint that she had been denied equal protection by a state or federal law. In that year, 1971, the court turned in a new direction. The justices began to respond favorably to the arguments of equal rights advocates who urged a more encompassing interpretation of the equality principle, one that would better serve U.S. society as it had evolved since the founding of the nation in the late 18th century. At the ACLU Women's Rights Project, launched early in 1972, and in the law school seminars I conducted first at Rutgers, New Jersey State University, then at Columbia University, work progressed on three fronts. We sought to advance simultaneously public understanding, legislative change, and change in judicial doctrine. I will focus in this class primarily on the litigation endeavors. In one sense, our mission in the 1970s was easy. The targets were well defined. There was nothing subtle about the way things were. Statute books in the states and nations were riddled with what we then called sex-based differentials. Illustrative laws were set out in an appendix to a brief the ACLU filed in the Supreme Court in the summer of 1971. The brief was written for the appellant in Reed v. Reed, first of the 1970s gender discrimination equal protection cases to come before the court. Among many entries, the Reed brief appendix included the domicile rule we inherited from England, a rule once prevalent in the states of the United States and elsewhere in the world, in civil law as well as common law domains. Statutes codifying the rule typically read, "The husband is the head of the family. He may choose any reasonable place or mode of living, and the wife must conform thereto." On federal legislation in need of repair, the Solicitor General of the United States, the Justice Department official who represents the United States in the Supreme Court, provided an important aid, perhaps inadvertently. The Solicitor General at this time was former Harvard Law School Dean Irwin Griswold. He asked the Supreme Court in March 1973 to review a decision in a case the ACLU had won at the Court of Appeals level, Charles E. Moritz versus Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Moritz had encountered undisguised sex discrimination in, of all places, the Internal Revenue Code. He challenged a provision allowing single women, but not single men, a deduction for the cost of caring for an elderly, infirm dependent. In Moritz's case, his aged mother. Congress had prospectively changed the law to eliminate that sex-based differential. With current and future dutiful sons accorded a benefit once reserved for dutiful daughters, there seemed to be no pressing need for high court review. Take the case, nonetheless, the Solicitor General urged, for the Court of Appeals decision casts a cloud of unconstitutionality upon the many federal statutes listed in Appendix E. What was Appendix E? It was a printout from the Department of Defense computer, an unexpected release in those ancient pre-PC days. The printout listed, title by title, provisions of the U.S. Code containing differentiations based upon sex-related criteria. It was a roadmap for reform efforts. One could use the Solicitor General's list to press for curative legislation and at the same time bring to courts contests capable of capturing public attention and accelerating the pace of change. But if our targets were all set out in the law books, our work encountered resistance in this respect. Our starting place was not the same as that of advocates seeking aid from courts in the struggle against race discrimination. Judges and legislators in the 1960s and at least at the start of the 1970s regarded laws mandating differential treatment of men and women not as malign, but as operating benignly in women's favor. Legislators and judges in those years were overwhelmingly white, well-heeled, and male. Men holding elected and appointed offices generally considered themselves good husbands and fathers. Women, they thought, had the best of all possible worlds. Women could work if they wished. They could stay at home if they chose. Women without husbands, earning a good income, of course, never had that choice. They could avoid jury duty if they were so inclined, or they could serve if they elected to do so. They could escape military duty, or they could enlist. So what was there for them to complain about? Our mission was to educate, along with the public, decision-makers in the nation's legislatures and courts. We tried to convey to them that something was wrong with their perception of the world. As Justice Brennan wrote in a 1973 Supreme Court plurality opinion, Frontiero v. Richardson, decided a year and a half after the court had begun to listen, traditionally, differential treatment on the basis of sex was rationalized by an attitude of romantic paternalism, which in practical effect often put women not on a pedestal, but in a cage. Those with whom I was associated at the ACLU kept firmly in mind the importance of knowing the audience, largely men of a certain age. Speaking to that audience as though addressing one's home crowd could be counterproductive. We sought to spark judges' and lawmakers' understanding that their own daughters and granddaughters could be disadvantaged by the way things were. We saw ourselves as teachers, appearing before audiences that on the realities underlying our cases had not advanced much beyond the third grade. To trace the story of when, why, and how women began to count in constitutional adjudication, I will start with a prosecution in a Hillsborough County, Florida courtroom, 1957, a little over half a century ago. Gwendolyn Hoyt stood trial there for murdering her husband, the instrument of destruction, a baseball bat. Gwendolyn Hoyt was what we would call today a battered woman. Her philandering husband had abused and humiliated her to the breaking point. Beside herself with anger and frustration, she administered the blow that ended the couple's altercation and precipitated the murder prosecution. Florida placed no women on jury rolls in those days, out of paternalistic concern for women's place at the center of home and family life. Gwendolyn Hoyt was convicted of second-degree murder by an all-male jury. Her thought was simply this: if women were on the jury, they might have better comprehended her state of mind, casting their ballot, if not for an acquittal, then at least to convict her of the lesser offense of manslaughter. The Supreme Court in 1961, a court headed by Chief Justice Earl Warren and widely regarded as actively liberal in outlook, rejected Gwendolyn Hoyt's plea. The court did so following an unbroken line of precedent. That precedent reflected the long-prevailing separate spheres mentality. The notion that it was man's lot, because of his nature, to be the breadwinner, the head of household, the representative of the family outside the home. And it was woman's lot, because of her nature, to bear and alone raise children and keep the house in order. Representative of that thinking, a 1948 decision, Gossert v. Cleary, had upheld Michigan's ban on women working as bartenders, unless the woman's husband or father owned the establishment. The consequence? A woman who owned a tavern and her bartending daughter were put out of business. In 1971, 10 years after the decision in Gwendolyn Hoyt's case, the Supreme Court reversed course. So did lower courts all over the United States. The turning point was Reed v. Reed. Reed involved a teenage boy from Boise, Idaho, Richard Lynn Reed, who died under tragic circumstances. His parents were long separated, then divorced. Rich's mother, Sally Reed, had unsuccessfully tried to keep the boy totally out of his father's custody. While Richard was staying in his father's house, he died from a bullet shot from one of his father's guns. It was an apparent suicide. Sally Reed, having lost her only child, sought to take charge of her son's few belongings. She applied to the probate court to be appointed administrator of Richard's death estate. The boy's father, Cecil Reed, later applied for the same appointment. The Idaho probate court rejected Sally Reed's application, although it was first in time, and appointed Cecil Reed under a state statute that read, "As between persons equally entitled to administer a decedent's estate, males must be preferred to females." An intermediate appellate court ruled in Sally's favor, but the Idaho Supreme Court ruled against her. Sally Reed was not a sophisticated woman. Once a white-collar clerical worker, she later earned her living by caring for elderly and disabled people in her home. She probably did not think of herself as a feminist, but she had the strong sense that her state's law was unjust and faith that the judiciary could redress her grievance. Ultimately, her faith was vindicated. The Supreme Court unanimously declared Idaho's male preference statute unconstitutional, a plain denial to Sally Reed of the equal protection of the state's law. 17 months after Reed, in Frontiero v. Richardson, the court held it unconstitutional to deny female military officers a housing allowance and medical benefits covering their husbands on the same automatic basis as those family benefits were given to married male military officers. Air Force Lieutenant Sharon Frontiero was the successful challenger. Lieutenant Frontiero had this clear view. She saw the laws in question as plain denials of equal pay. Sharon Frontiero, now Cohen, is not someone you would choose from a crowd as a potential frontrunner, nor was Sally Reed. Sharon is, and Sally was, an everyday person, uncomfortable with publicity. But they knew they had been shortchanged. They had the courage to complain, and they had faith in the capacity of the judicial system to vindicate their complaints. 2 years after Lieutenant Frontiero's victory, the court declared unconstitutional an Iowa law allowing a parent to stop supporting a daughter once she reached the age of 18, but requiring parental support for a son until he turned 21. That same year, 1975, the court decided a case dear to my heart, Weinberger v. Weisenfeld. The case stems from a tragic event in 1972 when Paula Weisenfeld, a New Jersey public school teacher, died in childbirth. Her husband, Stephen Weisenfeld, sought to care for the baby personally, but was denied child in care Social Security benefits then available only to widowed mothers, not to widowed fathers. Stephen Weisenfeld won a unanimous judgment in the Supreme Court. In defense of the sex-based prescription, the government had argued that the classification was entirely rational because widows, as a class, are more in need of financial assistance than are widowers. True in general, the court acknowledged, but laws reflecting the situation of the average woman or the average man were no longer good enough even for government work. Many widows in the United States had not been dependent on their husband's earnings, the court pointed out, and a still small but growing number of fathers, like Stephen Weisenfeld, were ready, willing, and able to care personally for their children. Using sex as a convenient shorthand to indicate financial need or willingness to bring up a baby did not comply with the equal protection principle, as the court had grown to understand that principle. As a result of the decision, child care benefits were paid to Stephen Weisenfeld, who has been an extraordinarily devoted parent. And what was once a widowed mother's benefit became and remains a widowed parent's benefit. Next, in 1976, the court's majority acknowledged that it was applying an elevated standard of review, heightened scrutiny, to overt gender-based classifications. The case was Craig v. Boren, in which the court struck down an Oklahoma statute that allowed young women to purchase near beer, a beverage that contains only 3.2% alcohol, at age 18, but required young men to wait until they turned 21 to buy the weak brew. It was a silly law, which the state sought to justify on the ground that boys drive more, drink more, and commit more alcohol-related offenses than girls. One might wish the court had chosen a less frothy case for announcing the heightened review standard. Still, it was a key doctrinal advance. What caused the court's understanding to dawn and grow? Judges do read the newspapers and are affected not by the weather of the day, as distinguished constitutional law professor Paul Freund once said, but by the climate of the era. The altered conditions accounting for the different outcomes in Gwendolyn Hoyt's case in 1961 and in the 1970s cases of Sally Reed, Sharon Frontiero, Stephen Weisenfeld, Curtis Craig, and several others were these. In the years from 1961 to 1971, women's employment outside the home had expanded rapidly. That expansion was attended by a revived feminist movement fueled in the United States in part by the movement of the 1960s for racial justice, but also, as elsewhere in the world, by the force of new thinking both represented and sparked by Simone de Beauvoir's remarkable 1949 publication, The Second Sex. Changing patterns of marriage, access to safer methods of controlling birth, longer lifespans, and in significant part, inflation, all contributed to a social dynamic that yielded this new reality. In the 1970s, for the first time in the history of the United States, the average woman was experiencing most of her adult years in a household not dominated by child care responsibilities. That development, a well-known Columbia University economics professor Eli Ginsberg said in 1977, might well prove the single most outstanding phenomenon of the late 20th century. Congress eventually weighed in, aided by the Department of Justice and a Civil Rights Commission report initially drafted by the ACLU Women's Rights Project, working with students in a year-long seminar I conducted at Columbia. The legislature eliminated most, but not quite all, of the differentiations based upon sex-related criteria on Solicitor General Griswold's 1973 list. In sum, the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1970s, as I see it, effectively carried on, in the gender discrimination cases, a dialogue with the political branches of government. The court wrote modestly, it put forth no grand philosophy, but by propelling and reinforcing legislative and executive branch re-examination of sex-based classifications, the court helped to ensure that laws and regulations would catch up with a changed world. Notably, some of the leading cases laying the groundwork for gender equality jurisprudence in the United States were brought by male plaintiffs. Of course, the men were complaining about discrimination rooted in a certain way of thinking about women, as dependents, much like children, subservient to the male head of the household. Cases like Steven Weisenfeld's helped judges, who in those days were almost uniformly male, to understand that overbroad gender classifications were problematic. Men, too, could be disadvantaged by sex role stereotyping. And, as Steven Weisenfeld's case illustrated, generalizations about the way women and men are may have unhappy consequences for children as well. Congress, in the late 1970s, continued to play a key part in the dialogue. The legislature had mooted a court case challenging the exclusion of women from the U.S. military academies, West Point, Annapolis, the Air Force Academy. Congress opened the doors of those academies to women. Change in that domain remained incomplete, however, until the Supreme Court in 1996 decided a case called United States v. Virginia. That litigation concerned the Virginia Military Institute, VMI, an all-male state college that had long served as a training ground for people who became prominent in their communities. The state offered no comparable opportunity for women. By the time the VMI case was launched, women cadets had graduated from the U.S. military academies for over a decade. The Marine Corps had elevated a career female officer to the rank of 3-star general, ironically perhaps, in charge of manpower and planning. Women in service were guarding the tomb of the unknown soldier, flying planes, doing so many things once off limits to them. The Supreme Court held in United States v. Virginia that the state had a choice. It could admit women to VMI, or it could close the school. Public understanding had advanced so that people comprehended that the VMI case was not really about the military, nor did the court question the value or viability of single-sex schools. Instead, VMI was about a state that invested heavily in a college designed to produce business and civic leaders that for generations succeeded admirably in the endeavor and that strictly limited this unparalleled opportunity to men. I regard the VMI case as the culmination of the 1970s endeavor to open doors so that women could aspire and achieve without artificial constraints. One last story from the 1970s. The case of Captain Susan Strzok, an Air Force officer serving as a nurse in Vietnam, where, in 1970, she became pregnant. She was offered this choice: have an abortion on base or leave the service. Captain Strzok's case antedated the Supreme Court's 1973 decision in Roe v. Wade, which held that women have a constitutionally protected right to control their own reproductive capacity. In those days, several military bases, without fanfare, made abortion available to women service members and dependents of service members. Captain Strzok, a Roman Catholic, would not have an abortion, but she undertook to use no more than her accumulated leave time for the birth, and she had arranged for the baby's adoption immediately after birth. She sued to fend off the discharge Air Force regulations required. She lost in the Court of First Instance and in the Court of Appeals, but she was well represented by ACLU lawyers in the state of Washington and each month was able to secure a stay of her discharge. The Supreme Court agreed to hear her plea. It was an ideal case to argue the sex equality dimension of laws and regulations regarding pregnancy and childbirth. The court's later holding that discrimination on the basis of pregnancy was not sex-based discrimination might never have occurred had the court considered and decided Susan Strzok's case after full briefing and oral argument. Solicitor General Irwin Griswold saw lost potential for the government. He recommended that the Air Force waive Captain Strzok's discharge and abandon its policy of automatically discharging women for pregnancy. The Air Force did so, and the Solicitor General thereupon moved to dismiss the case as moot. Hoping to keep the case alive, I called Captain Strzok and asked if she had been denied anything that could justify our opposition to a mootness dismissal. She was out no pay or allowance, she confirmed. Isn't there some benefit you wanted and couldn't get because you are a woman, I inquired. Of course, she said in our December 1972 conversation. I'd like to become a pilot, but the Air Force doesn't provide flight training for women. We laughed, agreeing it was hopeless to attack that occupational exclusion then. Today, it would be hopeless, I believe, to endeavor to reserve flight training exclusively for men. That is one measure of what the 1970s litigation, legislation, public education efforts in the United States helped to achieve.